Welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, sponsored by the National Association of Independent Artists.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. I'm Will Armstrong, and I'm a mixed media artist.
I'm Douglas Sigworth, glassblower. Join us as we explore the topics that affect the lives and livelihoods of art show artists.
Doug, not so long time no see. I just saw you 5 days ago leaving Houston. Nice to see you in a friendlier setting.
Well, I'm still sitting in Lot H. We're recording from...
I'm waiting for Master Blaster to blast the horn and let us know that the Road Warrior segment is ready to attack the show. That was a disaster.
That was hard. And they admit it was hard. They were struggling themselves.
Yeah, I admit to getting frustrated, and I don't want to dwell too much on that.
Here's the deal. I know I've been in contact on a couple occasions with Kelly, who is the executive director, and she is reasonable and she is rational. I had to deal with her, first of all, because I had theft in my booth this weekend.
You didn't just have theft. You kind of had people moving in, right? At least they left you a beer.
Oh, my God. That's true. That was my first sign. I opened up the tent first thing in the morning, and I only had a couple hours of sleep. I basically got back to the hotel and took a nap, came back at 8 a.m. When I unzipped the tent, there's a Budweiser sitting on the pedestal, and I'm like, motherfucker, someone's been in my booth. And then I start to look a little closer, and I see all the tubs are opened and everything's overturned. It's like, it was basically like ransacked. They were looking for some shit.
Somebody's been sleeping in Doug's bed.
Oh,
they ate your porridge, but at least they left you a lukewarm Budweiser for your troubles.
Well, I got on the hotline, you know, the artist hotline, and I was madder than a hornet. And if I would have had to talk to the director in that moment, cooler heads would not have prevailed. They probably would have got a very angry me. But I had a little bit of time before they came to kind of like take a few deep breaths, look a little closer at what was going on, become more rational. And we were able to meet on the same level, and they were great. They went out and they got what we needed to be able to do the show. They didn't take any of our artwork, but they took supplies that we needed to be able to do a successful show.
The show went out and got you supplies?
They did. They sent a staff member out to Home Depot, picked us up what we needed, brought it back to us, and we were able to carry on and do the show as if nothing was wrong. So
they bring you some ice for that Budweiser? I don't know that that would have, we're like, 8 a.m. in the morning, time for a lukewarm bud.
No, I don't think I would have touched that one with a 10-foot pole, cold or warm.
The problem I have with a late night setup is that, I mean, it's like by the time we got in to the show, we had 12 hours until the opening gate. That's at the time. It always takes me 3 hours to set the show up. So it's like, okay, that's already less sleep than I would want to get. And I don't sleep great in a hotel. And I don't sleep well if I know my booth isn't set up. So by the time I got back to the hotel at 1:30 in the morning and then set my alarm for 6 so I could go back and finish the setup, it's like I don't think that a lot of times shows realize that they're affecting everything about the show. You've got 200 crabby artists that didn't sleep well. None of us ate particularly well, though I know they tried to address that. Then you've got an entire day where you are dealing with the public, and the public is seeing, like, what's their perception of a bunch of artists that look like they're hungover because they got 2.5 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
But by the time, like Sunday rolled around and that whole thing started over again and we had to wait, I was so done. I was so exhausted.
Yeah. You know, we talked about this at the NAIA board meeting about when you have that narrow window of time for setup, that if anything goes wrong, it only exacerbates the problems, because if you don't have the staff to attend to the problems quickly, then it's just a huge catastrophe. So there's that.
Honestly, there are two things that we need. Access to our booths and parking and a way to get out. What I like is unload and get out, then come back and set up. That way you've got enough room for everybody to come in.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes with these micromanaged setups and breakdowns, it would work just as well and be less chaotic if they didn't do anything at all.
We do this multiple times a year. We know how to find the right spot where we can work together and to let our neighbors by and to be able to do what we need to do. So sometimes just leaving it up to the artists, it might move a little more smoothly than trying to have a hand on how every little thing goes. You know what? There were a lot of things that happened this weekend, and we don't want to get into all the details on the podcast. Plenty of people are commenting on it on social media, and they have their opinions on things. But what I can say personally from being there and participating is it's hard for cooler heads to prevail when you're on lack of sleep and a series of physical challenges, the heat, and all the different problems that were coming down the pike. By the end of it, everything was heightened and everything was a challenge. And I hope that things can get smoothed over and the wrongs can be righted after the end of this weekend.
So, Douglas, we all know that Bayou was a little bit stressful. The setup and the loadout can always be a little bit challenging, to say the least.
Yeah.
But I, to admit it totally, I was going into this show totally stressed out. Okay, I've got a Dodge 3500. It's a 2010, so it's an 11-year-old truck. It's got like a quarter of a million miles on it. It's a beast. It's a workhorse. But
yeah.
I was driving downtown in Santa Fe to go pick up my daughter from volleyball practice. So I'm rolling down Agua Fria in this gigantic pickup truck.
Yeah, this tank.
Yeah, it's a tank, and my brakes go.
Jeez.
I tap my brakes, and the pedal goes all the way to the floor with zero resistance. Whoa. Pull the emergency brake, and the emergency brake cable is severed. I have no emergency brake. I have no regular brakes, and the traffic is stopped up in front of me, and it's coming up fast. I mean,
oh,
I was probably we're like 15, 20 miles an hour at this. It's not a huge thing, but you drive a quarter ton pickup truck
right
into the.
It's going to do some damage, man.
Yeah. So I grab the wheel and I'm like, there's nobody coming. It's a two lane road. There's nobody coming in the other way. So I go to jump into the other lane and go around them. Power steering's gone, which is not a big deal. I can muscle this thing, but I'm like, I'm wrenching on the side of this thing and I'm hanging onto the side of the wheel, just pulling. I feel like I'm in a sailboat and it's trying to tip me over. I'm pulling onto this wheel and I see the parking lot coming up ahead, and it's the exit of my kid's school. So into the exit and go up and over this curb, hold that angle, and just land this thing right in the empty teacher's parking lot. Like, your adrenaline kind of takes over, but at the same time, it was like I felt pretty good about how I handled the panic situation, because
yeah.
I felt like I'm like, okay, I'm 15 miles per hour Sandra Bullock into this thing. We're going to go speed. There's no Keanu Reeves going to save my ass. We're going to just go into this parking lot. So I didn't hit anybody.
Yeah, I'm totally thinking as you tell this story, it's like an action movie or something. And
slow-mo. I mean, there was – but luckily, I mean, it would have been a completely different story if it had been 3 o'clock instead of 5:30, because
yeah.
there were only nine kids in the volleyball team, and they're at the back of the school. I was going into the front and the rest of the people had already cleared out. So I didn't hit the fence. I jammed into the tall curb, and that stopped me from going back out into the street. But luckily, everything.
But you're okay. Nothing.
Nope.
No collision of any kind.
Collision of any kind. My truck is still in the shop. I've been having brake issues on that thing for over a year. It's still in the shop and they're trying to figure it out. But long story short is, I had to rent a van, had to go to Albuquerque to do it, had to go to 3 different spots in order to pick up all of my stuff to take it down to Bayou before I started the 12-hour drive. I mean,
okay.
I think I was, texting you on the way down there. You were left on, when did you leave?
Wednesday. It's like a 2.5-day drive for us.
Yeah. It's like 12, 13 hours. I didn't leave until Thursday night.
I remember. I'm like, you're just leaving now?
like,
you were right up to the wire, man, finishing work, picking up the rental vehicle. That's
yep.
a lot of stress.
So, yeah, I was stressed out kind of going into it. And if you get your mind set that setup is going to be hard and breakdown is going to be hard, then I think you can typically you can get through it. But my head just wasn't in that spot. And I feel like when somebody's standing there in front of you, when you can just go and do the show, it's like, it's right there. It just felt like the setup was just right there out of reach and I couldn't do it.
Well, that was kind of funny. I get a text from you. You're rushing around and you're trying to get to the parking lot where we're all getting staged. And you send me a text, you know, drop me a pin. I'm like, okay. And I'm like, how do I do that? And it's like old man here trying to figure it out. And I'm dropping you pins in the middle of the highway. And you're like, ha, ha, ha.
You dropped me a pin. I was like, where's the parking lot? And I was having trouble finding it. And I'm like, yeah, just Doug, just drop me a pin and tell me where it is so I don't have to look at anything. Here's a good example of why astrology does not work. Doug and I are within 22 hours of each other as far as our birthdays go. I don't think we could be any different. You're a packet reader. You've got like the GPS coordinates. You've got all the stuff. I've got like 17 packets in my dirty old chair that I haven't read. And I'm like, I don't know. Where's the thing? Where's setup? Where's the thing? I don't even know.
I said to him, the map is in your packet. He goes, yeah, I don't read maps on paper. There's no reading maps on paper anymore. Map.
Jesus Christ. Just tell me where to go. Don't tell me to turn left at the Texaco. Just tell me where to go. But that pin you dropped me it was in a tunnel. I was like, I got the thing, and they're like, and it's like, you have arrived at your location. I'm like, fuck you, Siri. Fuck you, Doug.
And my next text from you was, I am one wrong turn away from turning around and going home right now.
It's true. That's what I entered the show thinking about. So I ended up having a great weekend in spite of some challenging setups and breakdowns.
You know, one of the things that they did do really well at the show this weekend was they turned out the people. They turned out the buyers, and the crowds were huge this weekend in Houston.
They were. And if you weren't ready at 10 o'clock when they opened the gates, then you lost sales because people were psyched for a show. That Texas market, Houston market was really hungry. When I saw where the show was going to be, it didn't look good to me. It did not look ready for prime time. And I was super wrong about that. They did a great job. I thought the setting was, it had a couple of tweaks that they could use, but I thought the setting was pretty lovely and really worked out.
The collectors liked that you could go down one street, turn around and come back the other street. It felt to them manageable. It felt like a loop. It didn't feel like going down all these different blocks. The layout was clean. And so that was some feedback I'd gotten from people who bought from us.
I do like a loop. Down one street, back the other side is great.
Hey, I also heard from some artists about how everything went this weekend in Bethesda.
You know, I love that show. And I was bummed that I'm not an East Coast guy. It's easier to go down to Texas than it is all the way back to Maryland. But I love that one. And it was our friend of the program, Deb Adelson, was on a billboard down there. So that was exciting. Yeah,
oh, she was. Excellent. Well, I heard from another jeweler, Margie Rawson, a good friend of mine. She said, good turnout. It's another one of those rough setups. You have to get there in the middle of the night. They don't shut the streets down until after dark. She said people were there. One thing her and her neighbors and other artist friends shared was it wasn't a big ticket sale show. And that was surprising to her. And so she made the comment that she made it to her goal, but she was like climbing up a mountain, one pair of earrings at a time. So,
well, it would be interesting to talk to some 2D folks. That's always been strong for me. And I've sold some big stuff there over the years. So be cool to hear from some other people. But I don't know. Overall, the shows, people seem to be hitting their goals. So that seems to be good.
Definitely. Yeah, I've been in that category. I feel like I'm happy with what's been coming out, and the averages have been where I want them to be, and that's good. You know, we did a lot of sitting around hoping this would be the bubble. The bubble would
be
there.
It's so funny you talk about, you brought Bethesda up, and I'm like, oh, I love that show, and then you're talking about the early morning setup, and I'm like, you know, it's so funny how easily artists, me especially, have the tunnel vision. You know, I'm like, oh, I like Bethesda. I like the whatever. And it's like, well, do you remember that you had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go set up? I'm like, no, I don't. I've totally forgotten about that.
I know.
If I had just come back from Maryland and the East Coast, I'd probably be like, oh, the setup was so brutal and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'd be complaining like I am about other things. So it's interesting what we do to ourselves and how we think. It's almost like kids, you know, like, oh, I remember it being a good time. I'm like, you cried all day. You had a
you know? I do call that like application amnesia when the applications come around again. And I kind of look back at, you know, how the sales were for that week. I'm like, oh, that's a great show. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I forgot about this. And I forgot about that. And I forgot.
Yeah. It's absolutely show amnesia.
There are some directors who believe that you're only as good as your last show. And if you have a crappy show, if bad things happen, if the weather's bad, artists remember it. They don't apply. And your next year numbers are down.
That goes across the way. It can be artists, too. My impression of myself is I'm only as good as my last show. If I tank one, I'm like, well, I suck. My work is shit. You know, I'm
Mr. Extremes.
Yes, I'm Mr. Superlative, Doug. You know it by now. I mean, everything's either the best or the worst with me. And if I have one bad one, I'm like, well, better scrap this and get a job at Home Depot.
Well, mine is always Starbucks. So your Home Depot, my backup plan is Starbucks barista.
You look so great in the little green hat.
What we were talking about at the last board meeting, the NAIA board meeting, the application numbers for Florida have been down. And perhaps these early shows that happened last year in the winter of 2021, maybe they came on the scene a little too soon. Maybe the public, maybe the artists weren't quite ready yet. I don't know. Huh. I wasn't there. So
interesting theory. You know, I did not do Florida shows last year, and I have not done any in the spring. But I wonder if, you know, you get a certain kind of artist that goes down to Florida and they do the circuit. And I used to look at Florida shows as one run, as opposed to like, you know, looking at my totals for each show. I look at my Florida trip.
That's the only way I handle that particular area is as a group.
You know, I'm wondering, are the kind of artists that used to go down to Florida for a month or two and kind of like the snowbird artists, are they also the kind that are retiring? Because I know a lot of people retired. You can get a lot of used tents and things on those artist garages. And I know a lot of folks stopped doing shows. And some of those folks, I'm like, man, those are the guys that used to go down to Florida for a month or two. Those are the ones that I used to see on the road down there.
You're saying on the garage group, you're seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of tents for sale. I'm seeing a lot of pro panels for sale down there. I'm kind of wondering, I'm like, well, are the younger, hipper artists thinking about Florida anymore? Like, are people retiring without replacing? So I'm wondering if that's the case. These little inklings of things that are bringing things down, like getting you to that 25% down in applications.
Oh, but right.
Who knows? I'm just speculating.
I think it's multi-layered. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is multi-layered.
You've got people retiring. You have Florida not handling COVID very well. So people not wanting to necessarily go down and support them. Mm-hmm. We should ask Howard Allen, Howard and Debbie, see what they say, if their applications are down too, or if they still have that core group of people that always do their shows.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of COVID, I totally had myself in a complete tizzy yesterday thinking I had COVID.
Well, we'd like you in a tizzy, Doug, but not for that reason. What's going on?
Oh, man, I get back from the show. And we've already discussed, it was a tough one, the long drive back. I wake up on Wednesday morning. I've got like shortness of breath. And then a lot of my symptoms started to become psychosomatic. And I'm like driving around town trying to find out, where can I do walk-in rapid tests? Where can I get tested?
Yeah.
And I was feeling sicker and achy.
Oof.
My wife just rolls her eyes at me. She's like, you're fine. You don't have COVID. At the end of the day, I had taken some Tylenol and ibuprofen. I start feeling better. And let's just say today I'm totally fine. I took one of those rapid tests. I am COVID free. But
did you grab an over-the-counter
test? Yeah, I took your advice on that one. It worked out
cool.
Good.
Yeah, I've got a little stack of those. And I like to take them before I get, you know, my youngest is not vaccinated yet because she's only 11, so they haven't cleared that one. But I like to take those before we get the kids back just to make sure that I don't have air herpes or anything else that's going to flare up. Douglas, I feel like I got down to the end of the run, that huge long run we're doing, and everything just starts kind of breaking down. My truck, me personally, it's just, I don't know if you can relate or not.
We've been having a rough time here, just trying to make work and physically get to the next show and set up and do the shows. And I feel like, you know, our personal life was taking a toll. My mother-in-law had some surgery. She's 80. She had a knee replacement. They live next door to us. And we were every 4 hours checking on her, getting her meds, helping her get up around. And with COVID, they didn't have a hospital bed for her. So they basically sent her home right after the surgery.
With a knee surgery?
With a knee surgery, yeah. Good Lord. It was pretty scary for us to make sure that we were giving her the right pain meds, in addition to, as an 80-year-old, all the other meds for other stuff that she takes to make sure we were on the right schedule. And that was all leading up to Bayou City. When we headed out for the show, kind of felt like we weren't fully prepared because we weren't able to devote as much time and attention to the work. And the work is the engine that runs our businesses. And if you show up without the work, then there's like no point.
Totally agree. I mean, I feel like lots of different things took a back seat, you know, like with all of the different shows that we had to do. And I'm coming home now and I'm looking at things and my studio is a disaster and I have clients coming over and trying to get used to living in a new town that I still am not used to living in. And it's hard and feeling like, oh yeah, my daughter is still dealing with this problem with her Spanish class. Mm. You know, it's like back to real life. I'm like, just letting everything kind of slip just a tiny little bit. And now I'm picking up the pieces.
I remember what we were talking about getting ready to get out the door. And you were like, okay, I just need like 45 uninterrupted minutes to work on a painting. You know what I mean? That's how I feel too in the studio. It's like there are days we weren't even able to get in the studio because there was too much other stuff going on that just we couldn't even get to it.
And then I feel like as soon as you start coming back from a show and it's the end of a long run, like that's when all of your custom people start knocking on the door. Yeah. They're like, hey, it's like they can sense your radius within your hometown and back to the studio. Okay. They're like, hey, are you back? Is it back? Are you ready to look at me? Are you ready to do this for me? How about this? Where's my painting?
Yeah.
I might tell a client that it's going to take them 6 months to do the painting, but it's really only going to take like a couple days before I actually start. I'm like, I'm going to schedule you 6 months away, but I'm not even going to start the damn thing until 3 days before I tell you it's going to ship.
We have the same
thing. That's an exaggeration, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. We had a gallery want some work for us, as it happens with galleries. You know, you're getting 50% of the sale. So we have a run of shows where we're getting 100% of the sale. And I basically gave them the date of having their order when I'm done with the run of shows, because I don't want to part with our work at anything less than 100% right now.
Exactly. I've cleaned out a couple of galleries kind of leading in when I had that whole leg injury. I cleaned out some dear friends that run a gallery in Chicago. That's the only way I had worked a show in Old Town, because I was like, oh, well, sorry, going to take your show away from you. But luckily the galleries that I have a decent enough relationship with that they understand the deal.
Cool, cool.
Hey, you mentioned having one more show, or are you done for the year?
Two more shows, actually.
Two more.
I'll be in Belleville this weekend coming up.
Oof, you're not done.
And then making a long drive out to California to La Quinta.
Oh, wow. Two big shows. Wow.
Two big shows. So
when's La Quinta this year?
2 weeks after this weekend. So it's early November. God. So I'm still feeling like I'm on that racetrack until I get back from California.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I hope we actually can make it out there because, you know, the one thing we're weighing, and I'm sure everybody is weighing, will we have the right work after this next show to be able to go out and do it? So that's the challenge we're all facing here at the end of the year.
Yep. It's funny. We talked to Daryl and a couple of others about slowing things down, and we all feel like chewed food by the end of this kind of run. And I can't believe your run isn't over. Your run, like 2 weeks between shows is like practically nothing, especially when you take a week going all the way to California from Wisconsin.
Definitely.
30 hours.
Hey, wanted to ask you, do you remember your first show ever?
My first show ever. You know what? I don't. No? I don't even remember it.
I remember it like business, it was yesterday.
Do you? All
yeah,
right.
I do.
Cool. Like mine was set up a little bit differently. You asked me, but my ex-wife and I used to do work and she used to do a jewelry business. So I saw her doing shows and then learned the ropes kind of doing that with her on the weekends occasionally. So I kind of, it was like a soft open for me. I don't really remember. I do remember with this body of work going down to Coconut Grove for the first time. So I do remember that, but I'd already knew how to do art shows.
Mm-hmm. Our first show ever, it was a local show. We showed up 2 hours before the show was supposed to start, thinking it was plenty of time. We get there and the whole show was pretty much open for business. And we felt like, what the heck did we do? You know, like we're late to class kind of thing.
Do you still have, I was going to say, that seems like a, I mean, I have art show nightmares. That sounds like an art show nightmare that you wake up from.
Definitely was one of those art fair nightmares. Well, we couldn't find our booth spot. So I'm so stressed at that point. I think, okay, I guess everybody just pops up a tent wherever they want. And I pop up our easy up right next to somebody's corner booth and was like, okay, this is a good enough spot as any right next to this guy. Well, as you can imagine, that didn't go over well.
You just set up wherever you wanted?
I just popped up my tent next to the end of somebody's corner booth.
It's Doug time.
And so it kind of turned into a scene. You know, people were like, you can't do that and you're in the wrong spot. And eventually the show director came over, helped us out, realized we were new, kind of calmed us down and pointed us in the right direction. So we're setting up all that kind of stuff. It was a race. It kind of felt like what it was like setting up for Bayou this past week. And we got set up and we met somebody at that show who I'm still friends with today. That's Margie Rawson.
Cool. You talked about her a little bit coming out of Bethesda. Was she helpful to you as far as setting up?
She was a mentor. She walked in our booth. She gave us advice, told us what we could do different for display, was complimentary of what we were doing, even though, honestly, I mean, looking back on it, yeah, our first show, our first work, yeah, not great. But she was so kind and so complimentary, and we're friends with her still today. It brought me back to that this past weekend because we were next to an artist who this was his first show ever, and we kind of got to reach out and be mentors to him.
Nice. You know, Doug, I already knew how to do art shows, but, you know, you never really forget your first time showing that work for the first time and getting people's impressions, which is what I loved about your interview with Jaja this week.
It started with, okay, let's help this guy. And I'm not going to give away too many details here up front because he is an interesting person. He has a really interesting backstory. But what I will say is on Sunday, when I hear clapping and cheering in front of his booth, it is not typical to show up to one of your first shows and win the Best in Show award. And so he told me more about his inspiration and the message behind his work. And I think everybody's going to love getting to know Jaja.
I'll be honest. My first reaction when you told me you wanted to talk to him was like, well, why? Is he really going to do shows again? Like he just did one. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what's the story? But man, I'm really glad you sat down with him. It's a fascinating talk and he's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed sitting down with him. Here is Jeribai Andrew Jaja.
This episode of the Independent Artist Podcast is brought to you by Zap, the digital application service where artists and art festivals connect.
You know, Doug, I was sitting down and talking with my wife yesterday. She had just come in from her studio and she was complaining. One of the big shows, they decided to do a do-it-yourself, reinvent the wheel application.
Hate that so much.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, it's like typically an application that would take you 2 minutes on Zap. All of a sudden, it's going to take you an hour and a half to reformat all of your images to their specifications. It just made me think about how easy applying with Zap is.
You just click a few buttons, you've got your 1920s all formatted, and you are good to go.
Exactly. So I personally appreciate what Zap is doing, and thanks for not making us reinvent the wheel every single week like we used to have to do.
Our guest on the podcast today is a newcomer on the scene. His name is Jeribai Andrew Jaja, originally from the city of Port Harcourt in River State, Nigeria. Jaja came to the U.S. to study at Brescia College. He
His hyper-realistic drawings are inspired by his quest for total self-love and acceptance. I look forward to sharing his story here on the podcast today, and I hope you will welcome him next time you see him out on the road at a show. Hey, Jaja.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you, Doug. I'm very good. How about yourself?
Good. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
For the listeners, your first name is Jeribai, but you go by Jaja.
Yes, my first name is Jeribai. My last name is a hyphenated name, Andrew Jaja. But okay. I'm mostly known by Jaja. For some reason, when I tell people my name, they just gravitate to Jaja.
And it's fun. I love it.
By Jaja. So I just go by Jaja.
All right. So when people see you, when they see your full name out, they can just call you Jaja and they don't have to feel uncomfortable. They know you're Jaja. Yeah. Well, we were neighbors here at Bayou City in Houston last weekend, and first time I ever met you, and I just wanted to have a chance to sit down and talk to you on the podcast.
Hey, I'm very much interested, and it's an honor to come to your podcast.
This was only your second show that you've ever done. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, that Houston ends up being like one of your very first shows ever. Tell me about your experience with getting into art shows.
In 2017, I graduated college, mm-hmm. and in a very small city, two hours away from where I am right now, Louisville. It's called Owensboro.
Okay.
So then I got a job to come over to Louisville. And prior to that, I stayed in a studio apartment creating works. I knew one day I really wanted to start going out there. Mm-hmm. I was just creating for then. I wasn't really putting myself out there. I felt I wasn't ready to go out there. So
you're just getting into the show market. You're just getting your feet wet and starting to learn how to sell all the things that you've been creating in your lifetime.
Yes.
Gotcha. Now, the first show you did, that was an emerging artist show, right?
Yes.
I guess I would call this technically your first show. Yes. You know what I mean? You showed up with your own booth and your work and you set it all up. And I kind of feel a little bit obligated as a veteran of art shows to let you know that the way that this setup went was not typical.
Oh, okay.
You don't usually have to sit in a parking lot a few blocks away for hours on end. Usually you could set up maybe the day before and then show up fresh on the morning of. But when I met you, when I first saw you, we were all rushing at 11 o'clock at night, pulling in after waiting for hours. And it was like chaos. There were artists trying to jump the different medians to park their vehicles, to get unloaded and on the street. So I just want you to know that's not typical.
Okay. That was my experience, the very first one too. Although I was home, but that wasn't my experience. So it was quite easier.
A little easier, yeah.
Yes.
Well, you also had the added challenge. We were setting up and we look over at some point and we realize you and your friend had all your stuff set, you know, sitting in the middle of your booth spot, and you were just kind of looking at the pile of stuff thinking, what do I do now? And I thought there's got to be something going on over there. So what was happening? Yeah.
So it was 2 years ago. I did my very first emerging show, right?
Okay.
So, uh-huh. That was when I got my materials, my tents, my walls and the roof and everything. And for some reason, I had a box where I put all those things, like the roof, the walls and everything.
Yeah.
So whenever I was coming for this show, I just picked up the box and the tent. Now, when I got there, I just realized I don't have the roof.
Oh my God.
It's been like a year ago. And I didn't think I would have removed the roof to put it anywhere else.
Right.
So I just realized I don't have my roof. So
it's like now what do you do? 11 o'clock at night, show starts tomorrow. There's like no room for error.
Yes.
And I remember Renee and I said to you, well, maybe you can go to Sam's Club. We're trying to help you brainstorm. But then you really took our advice and you went up and down the street and started asking artists if anyone had a spare tent. So what was going on there?
So I called the artist hotline and we were like, oh, they would ask if they do have like a rental. But they had run out of the rentals too. So they were like, just like yours, they, you know, you can just wait till tomorrow. They were like, you can just go home and rest, wait till tomorrow, maybe just get like a pop-up tent in Walmart or Sam's Club or something. I was like, well, that would be my very last option because I've already seen how hectic it was to get in. I didn't want to just start the show with that pressure, you know?
Right.
So like, well, almost 200 artists here. Someone must have an extra, or someone might mm-hmm. know something. So I just took it upon myself to nicely ask everybody I could ask. And some people did not have, but they gave me other options. Someone gave me like a plastic bag. I can just cover it up for right now. Just different ideas. They were very uh-huh. welcome. So mm-hmm. that really encouraged me. I was like, no, my help is somewhere close. So I just kept on asking, and I found someone that kind of knew me. And he was like, oh, are you the person? And he was like, oh, let him ask his wife. And his wife was like, oh, we do have an extra one. And that was just how that happened.
It's like the Amazing Race when you're having to do those challenges and you're feeling all down and out, and then something comes through.
This was like after 1 hour of asking different people.
Oh my God. Time was so like, it was setting up that late. It is just like you lose track of time. I didn't realize it took you an hour to talk to people about it. Anyway, the good news was you got the tent, you yes. got your work up. You yeah. showed your work, had a successful show, and then you won the best in show for crying out loud.
Yes. I'm still waking up from that though.
I tell ya, it's an amazing thing. I mean, not yeah. only it, like I said, it's unusual. It's unusual that kind of setup and some of the things we went through, but then it's unusual to be like your second show out of the gate and you win the best in show at a prestigious show like that. There was a yes. lot of high quality art at the show. Yes. So congratulations. And it's very well deserved.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I didn't see that coming, but thank you so much.
Your work. It looks like you have been doing this for a long time. I'm just really impressed with the quality of your work.
Thank
Can you tell us about your work, your medium, and what you do?
So I'm a hyper-realistic drawing artist. Mostly I focus on human portraitures. I also do like, you know, animals and stuff, but mostly human portraitures. And I mostly do black and white using graphite or charcoal.
Okay.
The whole art stuff started, you know, while I was growing up, wasn't just really into drawing. I was just, I call myself just like a general creative. You know, I was into where you just get like some cardboard sheets, cut it, try to create a house, you know, just mm-hmm. different stuff, trying to create cars. I always play toy cars, you know, taking them apart. Just, I was just very curious and a creative. I love to create stuff. So I also found that I loved to draw like comics and cartoons and stuff like that. But wow. one thing I really noticed was whenever I drew those things, even if they were cartoons, I found out that I was very detail oriented. I tried to always try to capture something, a detail, you know, and I think that's what kind of just continued. I was never great at drawing human portraitures, never. When I came here to the United States, I came here to study computer science. And as a matter of fact, I'm still studying. I'm doing my master's right now in cybersecurity.
Okay. And so when did you come here?
I came here in 2013.
And where from?
From Nigeria.
So you came here on a scholarship to the college that you went to?
Yes. So the scholarship was from my state government back home.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a scholarship, just kind of like the show where you kind of apply and just the jury process, you know? So like over like 16,000 people applied for that scholarship, and through different jury processes, interviews and stuff, 160 people out of 16,000. And I happened to be one of those.
Wow.
That's yes. Awesome. It was very strict jury process.
Tough standards. Yeah.
Yes. Very high standards. So they gave me that scholarship. Then I came here and I was studying computer science, but I always had that art stuff in me. So initially, the story is initially this creativity part was taking me towards architecture. That was my real, that was the love I had then. But whenever I was coming here, the school they were putting me into did not have architecture. So I was like, you know, it's America. Maybe after a few years, I can transfer to another school that has architecture and stuff. Yeah. But when I came here and I started, there was like a roadblock from the sponsors of the scholarship. So the roadblock was that there was a change in the government, and the new government did not really support that initiative from the old government.
Okay.
And this was 2 years into my college of a 4-year degree. So 2 years into this new government kind of stopped that program. And so I was a little bit stranded. So,
wow.
Yes.
I see. So you were able to take advantage of the program to come over and go to college, but then they kind of ended what they were offering you. So what did you do with that decision? Did you have to decide whether to stay here kind of on your own or to head back home? Is that the deal?
That was kind of the point I was in. I was stuck between there. So, and it was around that point I was ready to transfer to the next school to study, you know, my program, because the new school needed proof of sponsorship and all those things. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't really trust me because I'm just new. But this other school, I've been here for 2 years and I was an honor student, so I could work something out with them. So I told them my situation and I told them I would go ahead and apply to be able to have a permit to work. So I would be working and be paying my tuition, no matter how small it is. And mm-hmm. just they saw reasons to that and helped me out with that. So
they have like conditions on you being able to stay in this country.
But that did not affect my status here. So
okay.
I just had to, the real thing was just to be able to continue college, and this school worked it out with me. So I couldn't transfer to do the architecture and all this stuff. So that's where
the thing you really wanted to do. You couldn't kind of branch off and kind of just follow your dream. You had to stay on the course that you were already kind of assigned to.
Yes, kind of that situation. So whenever I stayed back and I was like, all right, computer science would be the great one to go for because it's still like an integral part of any industry, you know. So that's when I was like, okay, let me open myself towards computer science. But while I was doing that whole situation was still very, very hectic. So that's where I kind of now branched out into, oh, I always love to draw. Let me just start drawing as a way of just feeling good about the whole situation.
It was an outlet for you. Was it intended to be a career, or was it more intended to just kind of like help you through whatever you were feeling in that moment, the stress?
It was more of that, but me just drawing kind of made me connect back to what I really wanted to do, because architecture involves a lot of drawing. So at that point, I knew I could not do it in terms of schooling, so I decided to go personally. So I just didn't want to lose touch of that no matter the route I went. So drawing, just normal drawing, just became part of me. And it was a great outlet and it just a way of keeping touch with that career.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. How did you learn the techniques that you use?
All right. So whenever I started doing that, like I said, it wasn't my major in school, but I started just being friends with art people so I can talk to them about what I know. You know, I became friends with like art teachers. So whenever I draw, I just go show them, you know, stuff like that, join their classes just for the fun of it. And I really realized that I really loved hyperrealism portraitures. So I came across some very great hyperrealistic portrait artists on Instagram. And one of them is named Kelvin Okafor. He's a UK-based artist. So and his drawings were very realistic. And so that really made me feel like I really have a knack for attention to details. And I really didn't see exactly like tutorials on all these things online then. And this was 2015. So what I did then was when I saw the artist, I started searching out for other artists online. And what I did was whatever pencil they had, whatever material they had on them, I would save up money to buy those just to play with those. Not because I really saw them do what they were doing, but I already had that the basic knowledge. I kind of had basic knowledge on blending, shading, but not having those, you know, hyper details. So I started playing around with that. So I see some people, you know, different materials they use, and I just buy them and try to do what I saw on their pictures. So I started doing that, and I just started loving it better and getting better at it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and you stayed really connected to the process and learned as you went.
Yes.
That sounds like a real tough situation where you're here, you don't have family here, your family is far away across the world, and you're stuck and you just kind of have to figure it out for yourself.
Yes. I mean, that was a very, very major, like the genesis of going through situations like that. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of branched out into different things.
Were you able to form a network of people around you here?
Yes. So I think that was when I kind of knew, hey, just like the situation I had, the show, right? I knew, okay, mm-hmm. I had to talk to people. So when that happened to me, I really didn't keep my mouth shut. I started talking to people, random people. Mm-hmm. And I just started going out to the park, just meeting people. I'm making friends, and I met this guy one day that, you know, invited me to some gatherings, some fellowship and stuff like that. You know, they want to know me and they want to really know what is happening with me, and I kind of had some trust with them. So I told them my situation, and that is how I just started connecting with other people. They could reach out to some people that told, they said they came to my school, talked to my school. So stuff like that, different people just willing to help me out. And that was how I kind of overcame that situation. And that was one of like the hardest situations. No other circumstance was really as hard as that one. But the only thing that particular situation kind of made me understand, you don't have to keep your mouth shut. You have to talk.
Put yourself out there. And how was your English when you came to this country? Was it, you know, something you had to get better at, or did you come with a really good grasp of language?
Yeah, I did come with a good grasp of language because English is our official language back home.
It is. Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. What is home like? How does it compare, would you say, to what you experience here?
What really made home is just my family. I was really in touch with my family. So when I left them, I've not seen them in 8 years plus right now. I'm still looking forward to visit them. The major changes, you know, is stuff like food. I've gotten very much used to the food here now. That is not really an issue for me. And the weather was much hotter back home, but not as humid as some places here though. It's very hospitable here too. I didn't feel very isolated. Because I'm kind of a person where I can survive on my own. I'm not scared to ask for help if I need help. And I noticed when you come to America, people mind their business. But if you ask them for help, they can come in and help you. So that's what I noticed, that sometimes you have to. Unlike back home, even if you don't say something, some people might not mind their business. They might just come into your business, you know. But
right.
Yeah. So that was one of the major differences. Here, you kind of really have to ask sometimes, and you see how great people can be.
Here, you have to actually ask for what you need.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people will just kind of let you go.
Yes.
So a few years ago, you started to have a physical change happen that really kind of has affected your artwork and affected the rest of your life. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. So in 2018, I already had a job. I was working in the IT field. And at some point in my drawing, I decided to, okay, I don't just want to draw random people. I want to draw something that I've been through some experiences since I came here. I want to start drawing things that relates to those experiences. So that was when I decided to start creating conceptual drawings and not just drawings of random people. So while I was in that process, I just realized I had a spot on my face. I was like, you know, everybody has some lighter spot on their face or darker spot. That wasn't an issue for me. But I found out that spot was spreading like rapidly, and I was very much concerned. And whenever I made an appointment to the dermatologist, it was like a month plus, and it was spreading every single day. So I was very insecure about it. I had already started my own personal research, and I was seeing different diagnoses and stuff like that. But one of the ones that really stood out was this vitiligo. So I was like, it might be vitiligo. So finally had my appointment, and in less than 5 minutes, I was thinking it's going to be something that you're going to sit me down, do a lot of tests, whatever. Nope. She just put down like a light on my face and said, oh, you have vitiligo. But it's nothing to worry about. It's not life-threatening. It's just a skin cosmetic condition that makes you lose your pigmentation. And they didn't really offer any solution because there's no really long lasting forever solution. It's just,
it's not a health yeah. risk. It's a, you said it's a skin discoloration yeah. and you start to see your face and your skin change. And it's gotta be scary to see yourself change like that.
Well, there was nothing I could do. I just went back home. And at that point, people had not seen, the spots were not very visible, but it became very much of a great insecurity for me, even when there was just 5 spots, because I felt everyone is seeing it. And from my research, stress induces this and makes it spread more. And I just couldn't handle it. I was stressed out, you know? And
well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know the feeling of, we get a pimple yeah. or something, and then we stare at that one thing in the mirror mm-hmm. and feel like we're trying to hide it and cover up. If you're seeing your face changing all over the place,
yes,
and it's growing, there's got to be a sense of panic.
And it just seemed as though each time I panic, like 5 new spots comes out, but I couldn't help mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm, and it was mm-hmm. spreading so fast that at that point, many people had not noticed that. So it became very much of an insecurity. I was like, well, I don't want people to see it then till I figure it out. I just felt, okay, I went to Walmart, got a skin tone. That was my first time shopping for makeup. I didn't ask nobody. I mm-hmm. just went and figured out, okay, I have to cover this up. I never just wanted to stare at my face then. I just always covered it up when I came back home. Didn't look too much because each time I look, I see a new spot, you know?
Yeah.
I just kept them.
Which then increases yes. the stress and then increases the yes. alcohol.
It's so funny because I was trying to not be stressed out, but I was still stressing out, you know? So
yeah.
I just chose, okay, you know what? It's happening. Let me just cover it up. I'm naturally this outgoing, confident kind of guy. And that was taking a toll on me. I felt like I couldn't be myself. I might be at work right. and when I go use maybe the restroom, I see, oh, my makeup is fading on this spot. I always had my makeup kit handy. I do that. So I was feeling mm-hmm. I wasn't just accepting of myself. And I wasn't feeling myself, you know.
And you didn't want other people to see yes. what was real either. You wanted to have them see a different version
yes.
of you.
So I was always struggling back and forth with that, with the mindset that hopefully one day, even if this doesn't go away, I can accept it and not feel this stress of, oh, someone might see one spot and ask me, you know. Mm-hmm. I just kept on feeling like that.
Well, how did the change happen? How did you become more comfortable with what has happened to you?
The vitiligo covering up makeup became like a morning routine. I never forgot. It was just mm-hmm. normal. I didn't even think about it. It was just part of my morning routine. My IT job now migrated home. Before in 2019, late 2019, just before the whole corona stuff. So I was working from home. So that wasn't part of my routine anymore. I wasn't covering up with makeup. Mm-hmm. And I worked at home for like 3 months. And they were like, hey, you need to come next week for a training. Just like it wasn't part of my routine anymore for 3 months. The morning of the day, I was driving to work and I looked at my mirror and I saw, oh my God, I didn't put on my makeup.
It wasn't like second nature anymore. You just yes. got up to go, like as if you were getting up to work yes. in your home office or something. And then you were like, whoops, I forgot this.
Yes, I had the chance to go back home. But one part of my mind just said, I've been looking for a way to accept this and let people see. Regardless, mm-hmm. if I go back now, I'm missing out on the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I would go to work like this and I wouldn't pay no mind to my face. I would just go like it's normal. Mm-hmm. And when I went, like I said, I was still, you know, the cheerful person. I didn't pay no mind to like what my face was. I just went and did my job. And I was like, if I can go and I don't die today,
yeah,
I wouldn't, you know, and that happened that day.
You made it through and no major trauma happened.
Yeah.
You made it through the day and
yeah.
got home. And
yeah. And of course, people saw it. But like what I told myself that day was I wouldn't put the energy on my face. And if I did it, then I'm pretty sure people would see it. I didn't change. I just went to work and did it. And when that happened, and I was like, oh, for the rest of the 2 weeks, I'm going to go without my makeup. And okay. that really like made me feel like very much courageous. Like, I can do with this thing.
Yeah.
Then just that situation quickly clicked. And I was like, I can create an art that talks about that my experience, like I've always been doing. But now this mm-hmm. art now is now specifically tailored to this experience. And just mm-hmm. because this experience is not going to go away, it might keep on building.
One of the pieces I was most drawn to in your booth was your self-portrait. And you are so hyper-real in your depiction in all of your pieces. Every pore, every little whisker, every eyelash, it is almost like you could reach out and touch it. And you gave that kind of specificity to the vitiligo on your face.
Yes. Vitiligo is about the details. I could see every little spot of my face. Mm-hmm. So whenever I could finally go out to the public and not feel too insecure, I was like, you know what? Let me take a picture that shows how I feel finally going out there. Because I wasn't really happy, but I knew it was a step mm-hmm. towards it. Mm-hmm. So I decided to take a very high definition photo that depicts the very first time in 2 years from the first spot, the very first mm-hmm. time or period that people saw my face without a makeup. Mm-hmm. At different times in my progress, I was always taking pictures. I was always taking mm-hmm. pictures just so I can remember from the very first spot. Although I lost those pictures, but I was always taking pictures. So whenever I did that,
Was it to track the evolution?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But no one saw the pictures or no one saw my face. So whenever that happened, then I was like, oh my God, I've defeated going to work. So now I was like, oh, I have to defeat maybe just going to my friend's gathering too. I have to mm-hmm. defeat maybe going to church, like going to places that people have seen me with mm-hmm. people with makeup, you know. So it was like stages by stages. And social media is a big deal, you know, when you're posting. So I was like, I don't want to just post on social media all of a sudden. How about I create an artwork and use the artwork as a reveal?
I was pretty impressed by some of your videos and some of the stuff you've put on social media where you actually took black marker and traced around the paler parts of your face, of your skin, that were the pigment was going away.
Yeah.
And you turned it into this experience online, into a TikTok video. And I noticed that thing went like all over the place. It was a huge trending video.
Yes, yes. So, like I said, I said I've seen all these tools that I can use to add some humor, but tell them my story. And since I've already said it very much, you know, overcoming that insecurity, I decided to use those outlets instead of just maybe just posting a video and just be like nothing happened. I just wanted to use those outlets to break into revealing my story. So I had created my artwork first. I posted it, but I had not shown my face because I was still very insecure.
Oh, yes. So your self-portrait was viewed, but your actual face was still being kind of hidden.
Yes. And that was me helping out myself because I decided, okay, let me use my art to steer the waters. Just start gradually opening up. While this whole situation was going on, I was always thinking, how can I use my art for the purpose of this? That was what I was always thinking about. How mm-hmm. can I use my art for a purpose, you know, to do stuff like this? So that quickly clicked. I was like, okay, I can use my art to talk about my story. And at some mm-hmm. points now, finally come out. And since I know it's something that keeps on going, and just keep up the progress through my art, document this process through my art. That was when the old idea came. So that was when I first of all put out the artwork and people were like, you know, very great work, but they hadn't seen my face. Then when I now put out one video on TikTok first, that was when I started being active on TikTok, which was last year, October. I put out that video on TikTok where I had a makeup on. But while the mm-hmm. video is a song that talks about being who you are. So while the song was going on, I was telling them my story which I've always been telling. But while I was doing that, I was cleaning out my makeup. So I just try to make it a little cinematic, you know, where you see me just taking out my makeup. And at the end, I threw my makeup, whatever, the stuff away, just saying I'm no more wearing makeup. And I didn't really think that would go viral, but that went very viral. I got thousands of messages, thousands of comments telling me how that has inspired them in various aspects of July. People telling me they do have vitiligo and other skin conditions or just general anything they were going through. And that was really empowering and inspiring to me because I was just doing it for myself. I was like, okay.
Right. And it was for you to be able to feel like you could stand in front of a group of people and get through that awkward period of saying, this is what I've been kind of holding sacred and not wanting the world to see. And now I want the world to see it. So that process was to help ease that stress. And I'm assuming that all of these reactions online helped you feel accepted and loved.
Yes.
But then everybody's got an insecurity in some regards.
Yes.
That touches them and it forms that connection that you could share with them and they could share with you that we can let it all out. We can just be.
Yes. Yes.
It's beautiful.
Yes. Yes. And after that, I was just like, I couldn't really handle that because many people, I had several interviews, several, you know, talks and responding to DMs and stuff like that. Then at that point, I was like, oh no, let me just keep telling, let me now keep creating these drawings that not just talk about the physical, but how I felt on the inside too. So I started creating drawings that showed my emotions because I know these emotions that lead to the physical changes. You know, if I feel stressed, more spots come out. So I also created a drawing, which is with the animal within that talks about when I really feel stressed about it. So I was, I now felt this could be a live series because this situation is something that could last for a lifetime. It could stop by itself, you know, but at that point, this situation kind of burned another purpose for my art and created that series that I felt I could start. So I called it Black Metamorphosis, which is changes, and my melanin journey, which is me losing my melanin. So that was how the whole stuff started.
Wow. I would also anticipate that your pieces take so long to make.
Yes.
So you spend so much time on that self-portrait with what you're going through with the skin changes, and you're working on the shading and you're working on the detail. Was there actually a period of actual acceptance and loving the image that you were seeing in front of you? So it wasn't just about the revealing it to people. It was also about you not feeling like it was something you didn't like anymore. You know what I mean? Like, were you falling in love with that image?
All right. So it was two parts. The self-portrait one, whenever I started doing it, it was a mixture of fighting against myself and loving myself. So that 170 hours is a mixture of, I don't want to do this. Should I really do this? And another part telling me, spend your time and enjoy and choose to love these spots. That's why you feel, you can feel the emotion part and you can also feel how detailed it was because I really wanted to draw it and own it and accept every detail through my art because that was my outlet generally. So I was pouring out the emotions and making sure I spend as much time as I can to draw that spot that I could see as a form of I'm accepting you. I'm putting my time. I'm investing my time to accept you. Sometimes I cried. Even when I even finished this piece, it took me a while to post it because it was just like, an insecurity, you know, I just don't want to post
for sure. You really, you almost seem like you embraced that too, that insecurity through these TikTok videos. Another one I found really interesting was you decided that you would face the viewer and you would take a clipper and shave your head so that you and the viewer at the same time could see what vitiligo has done through your scalp. Yes. So it was such a revealing moment of vulnerability. Saying, I'm going to share this with you, see how I can be vulnerable. And that was another one that just went crazy across the internet.
Yes. So whenever I could finally show my face And for those mm-hmm. 2 years, I kind of knew something is happening on my head, of course, you know, but I had not, mm-hmm. that was, you know, steps, you know, different steps. So I could face mm-hmm. face mm-hmm. one, but I was always leaving my hair, always wearing hats and stuff like that. And it was not about me anymore at that point when I saw the way, you know, people reacted to it and the way it could help other people. So that really, really boosted my spirit to be like, okay, you know what? Now let me finally see what has been under my hair. And I feel that would also help me out in accepting this process and also help others out. So for that particular one, I didn't do it beforehand. I decided to do it at the same time I was posting the TikTok.
Yeah. Lifetime.
Lifetime, yes.
And did you tell me that you actually have gotten noticed by some celebrities in what you've put out there?
Yes. Quite a few, yes. And one of the biggest ones was Willow Smith.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is just, it's bizarre because we can sometimes just feel like we don't have that. We do what we do. We put it out there. And you kind of feel like it doesn't go that far away. But when it takes that kind of a spread and it starts to ripple past and you realize your effect on people, that is just so exciting.
Yes, definitely it was.
Speaking of social media, I noticed that on the handle that you use, you go by King Jaja.
Yes.
Is there a story behind that at all?
Yes, there is. I just like the fact that I can call myself a king. But that kind of started way back where I was growing up. I'm from a hometown called Opobo in River State in Nigeria, and it's a famous hometown back home. Okay. And it was created by a king called Jaja.
Really?
Yes.
Same name as you. Okay. Yeah.
And why I have the surname Andrew Jaja, it kind of goes way back. So before he created the kingdom, he was in a different kingdom. So he came and found this space and decided to wanting to settle down. He had like a couple wives. I'm not sure about the number. My great grandfather was the younger brother of one of his wives.
Okay.
And his name was Andrew. So whenever they migrated and they formed this kingdom, one of the honor he gave to one of his wives was to name one part of the kingdom in her name. So since his wife came with this man, her younger brother, he still kind of wanted his own identity. So he decided to have his name Andrew and take on the last name of her husband, which was the king. So that's where Andrew Jaja came in.
Wow. So you're a descendant from this.
Yes, I'm part of the lineage. Yes.
That's great. That's awesome.
And like I said, not just me, some other people, because, you know, the family grew and far and wide. So some people still have the name Jaja. And since he was just very famous, he's known as King Jaja. Like if you Google, that's the first thing that comes up.
That's what I found when I was looking you up online. I found King Jaja and I'm like, It correlates to your social media handles. So I thought there's got to be some story behind that.
Yes. Yes. So yeah, that's how it came about.
Cool. Awesome. So getting back to the topic of vitiligo, I would assume that the changes in pigment is more than just the physical, the vanity of, you know, the mundane level of your skin changing. I'm sure that there is some deeper connection to that.
For me, that's a very good question. For me, what I would say is, like you said, is definitely more than the physical. What this has really taught me was small things matter as much more than we can ever think about. The little things matter. Because at some point I was like, how come just these 3 spots on my face matters? I mean, I'm totally pigmented in every other space of my body. How is just these 3 spots the problem? Mm-hmm. And guess what? The 3 spots multiplied into like 7, 8 smaller spots. And those little things, we are the problem. Like I wake up looking, is there an 8 spot? You know, in the whole scheme of things, this has really revealed to me was just, you might not really know how much you really love yourself. You know, we give love to other people, but we might not really understand how much loving yourself can go. You might have beloved ones, a daughter, you know, brother, sister, father, and you're always, you know, giving. But how about giving to yourself? I was, like I said, I was a very, and I'm still a very confident person, but beyond the physical, I could see, oh my God, so I can really not love myself that much, you know? So that really made me understand the aspect of self-intimacy, like. So that was the major thing this whole process has really revealed to me, much more than the physical.
I was reading your bio and you were talking about how self-love is like the ultimate superpower.
Yes. Because I believe once you can love yourself, like nothing else can really hold you back. Like now when you can love yourself, I'm a Christian, so I believe in the Bible. And I believe when God says, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, you know, so your self-love is just kind of the meter that measures how much you can give love to someone else, you know, because you can't really give what you don't have. So if you really love yourself, you can be able to, you know, give love better to other people. So I think that is the superpower, using the word I use. Yes.
This process, this personal connection that your artwork has to help you with accepting and loving yourself and loving the things that made you feel insecure.
Yeah.
And it's been a good example to people online and through your artwork to reflect and do the same for themselves. Something else that I think is really important in your work is you said your subject matter is faces of color.
Okay.
And when I look at your pieces that are not directly connected to your current series about vitiligo, I look at the faces, these black faces that you have, and I look into their eyes, and they are talking, they are sharing, they are emoting. Your portraits show a vulnerability, and then they express an emotion that is revealing. It is, I think, healing to be able to see that and to have community with that. And it's important for people to see that message.
Correct. And what I would really say is, you know, specifically, like I said, you can feel very much more insecure when it's on the black skin because it's very prominent. It's very obvious. Because whenever I started this, I've also seen many, you know, Caucasian people with vitiligo, and you have to like really, really look, you know. So just generally speaking, my drawings have also created a community to the black community to also embrace, you know, their color too. So I wouldn't say that was the mindset behind it, but I've seen that evolving into that greater scheme of things too. Yeah. Right.
And it's powerful, powerful work. So, I mean, you were able to accomplish that with yourself, but you're also doing that across your whole body of work.
What really makes me feel some emotion before, because my creative process is I take the pictures first, then I create the drawings from the reference photographs. But I'm very much drawn to the emotions in the eyes. And I know people really can read and communicate with that, because the eyes is just phenomenal, the emotions that the eyes can give. So I'm very intentional about that process, because I just love the way that you can get something from it. Like I always say, my drawings communicate with my people, with the people viewing it. It might be silent communications, but my drawing can be a friend. The eyes just tells a story. So I always use either closed eyes or something that the eyes can still see, you know.
Well, but even with the expression, every little wrinkle or the shading in the skin, it just tells a story. It tells a story, and you feel connected to what you are sharing. It's powerful.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Well, this has been a really great talk, and I'm so excited, for one, to see you just hit the scene like this with such great work and to be recognized right out of the gate. I want everyone to keep eyes out for you, like you've done, ask questions. We were talking about, well, what's a better tent I could get? What's a better display I could get? You're going to have all the questions we all had when we started out, and we'll all be there for you. Just need to ask. Sure. And just, you know, everybody lend Jaja a hand.
Sure.
And help him out and point him in the right direction. And absolutely. Maybe he could point us in the right direction on how to use this social media selling our work on TikTok. Your TikTok videos are pretty amazing, man. I just love them.
Thank you so much.
I'm wondering, do you sell much work through social that way, or is it all, you know, are you more successful in person?
I sell on social, but I wouldn't say it's as much as when I'm in person, like at shows. And kind of probably mm-hmm. because, you know, people that come to shows, they are somehow ready to buy. So they can buy more on like socials, you know, but I do sell on socials too. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. You're a young guy and I'm trying to utilize those channels, but I still feel like I'm a bit outdated when it comes to trying to appeal.
Not at all. So not at all. You just have to put yourself out there. You appeal to people that you appeal to. Like, that's one thing about TikTok. TikTok is just open to be yourself. And when you are yourself and you give some value through art, music, whatever you're doing, people will gravitate to you. It might take a while, but when you're there more and more, there are resources that would make not just you bring in value, but how to present that value, you know, how a trend, there might be a trend. So what I do is I make whatever TikTok is, I make it my own. So
it's not one dimensional either. Right. It's not just about, I mean, your work has depth to it.
Yes.
But on top of your work, you're dancing, you're putting in music that you do. It's so multi-layered of your personality. Exactly. And it's just so cool. It's just cool, so cool to see.
Exactly. So, yeah, awesome. Well, I encourage anybody to go on TikTok. Yeah.
Well, this has been fun. Thanks for sitting down with me, Jaja. And I look forward to being next to you again sometime.
Oh, definitely. And thank you so much for organizing this Zoom meeting. I'm so excited and happy to be on a podcast. And awesome. I hope to be back and keep in touch with you.
Do you have any other shows that you've applied to that you have lined up? Anything coming up?
I've applied to some, but I've no, like, I don't know if I've been going to them yet, but like, that's the Main Street of Dallas. I'm mm-hmm. looking forward to that one. That, and I've not really applied to many others.
We're friends now. Give me a call and I'll give you some pointers and point you in the right direction, what shows you should be looking for.
For sure. I'll be so happy to hear that.
Awesome, man. All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Douglas. I appreciate it.
It's interesting to hear somebody kind of come out of their first show and actually have an interview with a podcast. So great talk. Interesting to hear what Jaja's perspective is. And he's hopefully a bright new light on the art show circuit.
He's got a lot of enthusiasm and I love what he's doing on social media and his TikTok videos. I mean, I kind of felt like an old crusty dude talking to him and watching his videos. And
you are an old crusty dude.
That's man. No, you're the old crusty dude. It was interesting to me how this generation uses social media as an expression of their personality. And he does that. It's like you and I, we make our artwork and it is very personal to us. But in some regards, it's what we make, it's what we take to a show, and it's what we sell. But his artwork is such a highly personal thing to him. It was part of his emotional healing and his quest for self-acceptance. And I was pretty inspired by his process and his journey with it.
Yeah, it's an inspiring talk. I loved listening to it. Actually, Doug and I have a new TikTok that we just formed. We're going to be doing some iPod dances and lots of little steps. And Doug, you've got an incredible ass. I just have to say that you really, that seems to be what they like on the TikTok.
TikTok. I really appreciate that's you. That's real nice how you did that. The TikTok, man.
Douglas Sigworth just has a dump truck of a rear end, folks. So you're really going to want to stay tuned for
that. Well, I will let you know that any song that I have suggested to use on our TikTok videos have been denied by Will Armstrong.
I don't really know that we're going to dance to Bridge Over Troubled Water again, Douglas. It's just not working for me. That is not true. Those are all lies. Those... But lots of exciting things coming up on the podcast. I've got interviews coming up with Signe and Gena Grushchenko, a couple of my art show heroes.
What? You've only been talking about them every other episode.
Because I love them.
No, it'll be fun to sit down. I'm not sure I can talk to Gena without pouring myself a healthy whiskey.
Okay, well,
so we'll see if there's if it's a drunken interview. I might interview at night as opposed to in the morning. We'll see how professional we end
up. That's good. No, that's awesome. Hey, I wanted to shoot out a quick thank you to one of our friends of the podcast, Sharon. Is it pronounced Spiller or Spillar?
It's Sharon Spiller. So essentially her last name is Speller, spelled wrong, which really makes a lot of sense if you follow her social media posts, because goddamn, that woman can't spell.
Oh, man. Well, we want to send out a thank you. She contributed to the podcast this week. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
She's a dear friend. Thank you for your support, Sharon. You are an amazing person. Thank you.
We also want to let everybody know that we do have bumper stickers. If anybody wants to pop a sticker on your laptop or on the back of your truck, just go onto the episode notes and click on the sign up link, and we will send you one out.
Or you can stop by Douglas's booth and get one for your truck. Don't come bother me. I'm not handing out bumper stickers at shows. I'm selling artwork.
It's maybe at the bottom of your old nasty grotto art fair
chair. Beautiful chair? My beautiful Hollywood chair? You can find that for sale on Art Fair Garage if you're so inclined. I promise it's a coffee stain and not a duty stain.
No, it's totally a duty stain. Everybody knows better.
Just sharded in my chair at one of a kind. It's true.
All right.
A story for another day.
Another day. All right, back to the studio, guys. We are getting to work.
I'm going to go clean the living room. I've got a guest coming over, so we'll see you next time. Douglas, thanks so much for doing this with me.
You bet, man. Same back at you. Take care.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Association of Independent Artists. The website is naiaartists.org.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. That's zapplication.org. And while you're at it, check out Will's website at willarmstrongart.com and my website at sigwithglass.com.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to be notified when we release new episodes.